continue where we last left off. We dealt with Maharal defending of Eliezer against Eliezer Ashkenazi. Eliezer Ashkenazi is saying that Maharal is against Emunat Yisrael. Maharal is then claiming his idea of everything being in the divine is the same as the Kabbalists. He then continues at the top of Reish Lamed Hey and says, don't you know that the Rambam was already criticized by Rav Chaska Kreskes? And he quotes from the Neve Shalom by Rav Avram Bilbado. And then on the top of Reish Lamed Hey, he's going to continue, and let's give an example of why he thinks he's right. And the next page, we're going to come back to his actual conclusions on this topic. So, Mr. Yavla, you're here. I can rely on you. Okay, so in Reish Lamed Hey, the first column, he quotes the Maarechet Elokut, which is an anonymous 14th century Kabbalistic book from the school of the Ramban. So unlike the Chevelle notes, which have very little to do with the Ramban's actual Kabbalah, Maarechet Elokut is actually the Ramban's Masorah of Kabbalah. He quotes that book. So continue Zelishono. About four lines down, five lines down.
The notion of Dr. Torah became a significant excellent. The whole Mitra, A.P. and Bill Kingdom said that A.P. is carrying a little bit of the whole East Kind of Torah. So, in the last minute, I'm not sorry.
Okay, so let me unpack this. I'm going to do it line by line, and then we're going to go back to it, and then we're going to go to what the Maharal actually says. He's saying that the...
What? What's his word
telling? Attributes. Like, you know, you are a yellow toad. Toad there is a toar. And I do recommend again Heschel's Dictionary of Medieval Hebrew on reference. It is worth having a copy of a photo, you know, putting the whole 100 or 80 pages into a photocopying machine just because all these words are there. Is according to the Kabbalists, all attributes are in God's essence, and everything that occurs has to be born in something, meaning you can't just be Tov, you have to be Yelad Tov. And then when you say Yelad Tov, the Tov applies to the Yelad. It has to be part of the essence of what is. Therefore, the philosophers, Chachmei HaMechkar, said that attributes don't apply to God. They distance all that. You can't speak at all about God. But the Kabbalists predicated attributes about God. For example, the sun and the rays. because sun is the ball of the chama, or it's a great light, and the rays that come from it are also still called part of the sun. And you should know that these rays are not an addition to the sun, but it's two ways of saying you have the actual star in our current language, and you have the rays that come from it. The relationship of the rays to the sun is the way Maharal explains Kabbalah, and therefore the Kabbalists differ from the philosophers, because for the Kabbalists the attributes are part of the essence, the same way the rays are part of the sun. And when they say words like Chachma and Bina, those are just like rays of the sun. There's no real intrinsic entity there. They're rays of the sun according to the Makabel. And all other names of Svirot are only, once again, names for these rays of what comes down. Okay? Now he's quoting this from Bilbago's quoting of Crescas' quoting of the Marechet. But what we see here, this is not the way a Kabbalist actually thinks. So let me unpack this and listen closely. For a real Kabbalist, Shemesh is Tiferet. You know, it's not just, oh, this is all rays of God coming down. There's a very clear quality associated. And even if you use the sun and the rays, you use Keter down through the Svirot, they still have they have specifics. What we have here is Crescas's critique of the Rambam using Kabbalists to support himself. Crescas was not a Kabbalist, Crescas was a philosopher. And Maharal now quoting Crescas as his example of what the Mekubalim actually mean. So let's go back again. Wherefore Crescas, unlike the Rambam, God is an unknown. God is not lacking in knowledge. For Crescas, one of the keynote of Judaism is to accept these Mesorot of the names of the Sfirot. Crescas explains it. What does this mean? This light and ray model. This is certainly not what a real Kabbalist thinks. A real Kabbalist doesn't think these are Toharim. A real Kabbalist would say these are like flame to a coal, in which there are different colors of the flame, and that even if it is interconnected like a gafchelet or a shalshelet, there are still different levels, the way we would say there are different heat levels between the blue, the red, the white. You know, there are parts you will burn your finger, there are parts you won't. Or if any of you ever snuffed it out from the blue, you will not burn your hands there like you will at the top. A Kabbalist will assume they are all different levels. Crescas will assume these are only names, nomenclature, Toharim, attributes. That is what Maharal is quoting as his Kabbalah. It's a little bit complex, but I'm playing this up so you get a sense of where Maharal is rejecting Rambam, not really a Kabbalist, and crawling into a space that's neither here nor there for what he wants. And if you turn the page, let Maharal now come back and explain himself in his own words. Lefecha. So I should have it marked, second column, on Reish Lamed Vav.
Lefecha, Nivru to Ereshah is made much of the Tamar Jerim Mavanat, and the Rehim to be in commotion of the religious and the Anaisa.
Okay, now we're going to bring together everything we did in the last two classes on Nisim, on God, and philosophy, and Kabbalah, because here Maharal says what he says. For the philosophers, something being created, Ben HaShmashot, meant that it was part of Teva. For Maharal, who says that the Sheshet Yomim is Teva, and Shabbat is complete stasis without any creation, anything that's created in Teva, that's outside of the realm of Teva, like Nisim, has to be Ben HaShmashot. It's a me'al. Why is it Erev Shabbat? Because it's me'al ha'teva, but it can't be Shabbat itself because that's all stasis and has no creation. So Maharal has this alternate reality of Nisim that is being created Erev Shabbat. That's why back when we were talking about miracles and we were talking about the ways to interpret it, and I said where Tamar Ross interprets Maharal as more like the Matrix in multiple realities, and I said I don't agree with that in the fact that what we're seeing is it's not multiple as if therefore just mind over matter. There is a clear one realm of things that were created Erev Shabbat that are Me'al HaTeva that are now seen as the Seder HaNes. And that you can switch back and forth between Seder HaNes and Seder HaTeva, not that reality as a whole is opened, and that you can forever go to that point if you have the ability to get out of the side of the 6 days of the week and get to that point. So the same way Shabbat is where Jews show that they're not in the realm of space and time, they are above space and time in the realm of pure stasis. The realm of miracles is also, if you can enter that realm, you show you are above Teva, and therefore you will now have the sun stand still. You will then have the sun go backwards, because all those things were created in that little block of time. It's not that we can decide right now, I want the Harlem River to flow backwards, if it was not created in that window of time, the possibility. So Shemesh Begivon Dom, Chizkiah and the Malalot of the Shemesh were all created within that window. Yes?
Does this manifest itself in like a mitzvah of some sorts? Like you assume that on Erev Shabbos you have a very big mitzvah right there.
Would you?
I don't know what he's saying. You have like some super unnatural kind of...
Meaning is Erev Shabbat something special because of this logic?
Well, he's saying that then it was, but is it...
Right. I don't think he goes in that direction. I wouldn't be surprised if I find a Hasidic sefer that walks through there and says, you know, the true miracles are Erev Shabbat. Shabbat, everything's over with. But the miracles, they're going to be Friday afternoon and there'll be soon to be a film, you know, type of approach. Okay, continue. Okay, so unlike the Michtam Eliyahu, who assumed that there's a higher conceptual, not tivi, but sichli, that the Gedolim have, or unlike our reading of Tamar Ross, who have multiple realities, but we're using the Matrix analogy, that it's also once again mind over matter. Here he's saying all miracles still are in the course of Teva. So it's not consciousness, the way most 20th century readers of the Maharal read it, but it's still the Tuch Teva. Continue.
The introduction of consciousness, which is by the model, Kama Pamid, the Buddha or Nagor Mahot. Well, these are the Shadow of Mishnah, the third part of the Buddha, which is the Shadow of Shadow.
Okay, so why did it use the number 10? Not because of any Kamut, like a real Kabbalist. Kabbalists are very into Kamut. Not because this is everything that was actually created Erev Shabbat. There are many more miracles that are not listed by Avot. But because anything that is Kedusha is a 10. And therefore all miracles by nature have to be 10s. And that will be his explanation for Eser Makot. Why did we say that Rabbi Akiva said there were 250 Makot if there were 10? Answer, because 10 is a way to say these are B'Kedusha. This is God's hand. But there really were many more.
The connection between a miracle and Kedusha is obvious?
For him, yeah. Because then once again, our binary pair, Teva Nes, Kedusha Tuma. Once you set up one binary pair, you can link it up with any other one. You know, rabbi, congregant, male, female, any binary pair, day and night, can be linked with any other one. You know, you can, this is, I'll give a good drasha from this. Rabbis are miraculous in Kedusha. Congregants are Teva and Tuma. You know, once he sets one up, any other one can be plugged in. Okay, any questions on this section? I think I got my point across on all this. Yes?
Yeah, this is, is he fair to pick like one machlokes? We're saying so he's not Kabbalist and he's not Halakhic.
Yeah.
Is this like just one thing? Or
no, actually you can do this to any topic.
Does he have a lot of these where he quotes his opponents?
Yeah. Not that many. Yeah, I'm more aware of them. And there are much fewer of them. That's why I picked these examples where he gives you all the names quoted.
Would you say that he has his own unique philosophy in terms of these kinds of things? Or he's quoting other people?
It's all unique.
He's quoting other people.
But it's never what those other people actually say. He definitely has his own very, very unique approach. Okay. New topic, before we get down to new texts, is the idea of self. Okay, there's class on So there's class on Wednesday. So we're doing the Netivot Olam Kerech Bet on Wednesday, if anyone wants to bring their own copy. Okay? Today is introduction.
To self.
And midot. Okay. I had already told you in the introductions that for Maharal, the self is not the seichel like for the medievals, but the self is through the whole body. Okay. Does anyone remember where we've had that once before, actually, inside? The whole body, yeah.
Korbanot?
What? Yeah, we had it by Korbanot. We had the fact that the self is the whole body.
What do you say about Nefesh, right?
Yes, that's the Nefesh. Now, at this point I have to quote a lot of scholarship on the Renaissance to help you go forward. Stephen Greenblatt, a Renaissance historian, points that one should not misread Renaissance books and think they have the 20th century sense of the self. They do speak of I, but they always define themselves in terms of something else. Meaning, if they talk about I, their next question is, how do you define the I, the self? Meaning, for a 20th century person, you could say, oh, you know, I am lonely, or where do I fit into the world? For a 16th century figure, the question is immediately, how does the I define itself? In the case of Maharal, you define yourself through Torah. There is a tension between the self and how does it come to define itself in Torah. Greenblatt shows that most 16th century figures will define themselves in terms of Christianity, or the Bible, or a ritual. But unlike here, where you can write poetry entirely about a self that's not grounded in anything, they always try to ground it. Yes?
For example, you said, I am lonely.
In Maharal's case, you can't say, I am lonely. You can say, I am isolated. Therefore, if I don't ground myself, it's going to be Atzvut, Pizur, and all the negative virtues. And if I successfully ground myself, then it's going to be Torah and the Seder Ha'olam. I'm bringing this out because we tend to misread many Renaissance works as if they're modern. So hold off on all questions. Let me get out for the next 10 minutes and Liz might explain it. Let's take the example of a Shakespeare soliloquy. And this is another scholar, De Gracia, and building on Greenblatt. When Hamlet gets up, to be or not to be, that is the question. We tend to read to be or not to be as if that was a real question about the self having to struggle with suicide. And that it's a real dramatic scene. De Gracia points out that originally the to be or not to be scene in Hamlet was not a contemplation of death, and that originally single characters were never ever on stage. But that sort of scene was something off on the side, either done humorously, almost like a clown, and then it's only in the 19th century that we recast it as a soliloquy. So Greenblatt's point is that even in Shakespeare, great moments when we think that they are about the self were originally about whether one should accept kingship or Christianity, or in Hamlet's case, the world to come. You were always asking, do I situate myself within a bigger scene? John Martin, continuing this trend, talks about how the 16th century had an inner self, a panemi, as opposed to an outer self. So when Laertes says to Polonius, to thine own self be true, means even though you have to put on the life of a courtier, you have to put on a phony external self, your internal self is something separate. So 16th century has a panini and a chitzon, and both of them have to be identified with something else. You are not a unique individual, but your chitzon is usually your position in life, and your panini is usually identified with religion. We are going to find the same thing within Maharal, in which your panimi should always be connected to God, while your chitzon could be in the level of gashmiut. So unlike the Middle Ages, that assumes we are a olam katan, we are a microcosm of something bigger, the early modern period, the Renaissance period, sees the panimi as your tzelem Elohim. So the question is, what is panimi before it identifies with God versus panimi after it identifies with God? And what role should this chitzon that's identified with the world of Teva, how much is it allowed to identify? And which cases does even the chitzon have to be identified with God? Yes?
Yeah. What are the dates that I just want to say?
What are the dates? For our purposes, from about 1450 to about 1750.
Tomorrow, isn't it?
Yeah. 1700. Before we start having a modern sense. Okay, so let's move on a moment. Benny Gross who used to teach in Bar Ilan, Mechlala, and everywhere else, one of these Frenchmen who made Aliyah, discussed in a different course, asks questions in all his articles on the Maharal, on the Tivat Olam, is how does the Maharal's concept of self compare it to self within Hegel, Kierkegaard, and Sartre? Because there clearly is a sense of panimi in Maharal. Rambam has no self. There is no panimi for the Rambam and the Ramban. You may have heard lots of 20th century drushes retrograding the self into the Rambam and the Ramban, but they entirely identify with the cosmic world orders. They did not have any separate sense of self. There is no personal I element within this thought.
So what are you? What are
you? You are a universal intellect, identifying with the Sechel HaPoel or the Spheros. All your individual, all the things you value today, like your childhood, your imagination, your emotions, were only seen as the things that take you away from God in the Middle Ages. Okay? So that's why for them prayer was contemplative, because you contemplate God, and why in the 20th century it's entirely about the self. There's been an absolute reversal of what's important between the Middle Ages and the modern period.
For Maharal, is the self also?
For the Maharal located in the Renaissance, it's neither 20th century self nor medieval cosmos, but this quality of panimi. And that's exactly why I gave this preface, is don't misread Maharal as a proto-20th century person. Don't misread him as a medieval. He is a Renaissance with all the other figures in the Renaissance. And but Benny Gross has these interesting articles wanting to compare him to the 20th century. So, for example, Benny Gross has one article dealing with the Maharal on busha, on shame. Maharal says we should always be in a state of shame. Anyone who is not in a state of shame is brazen. And that for Maharal, according to Benny Gross, the natural state of a human being is a sinner who is always ashamed before God. Meaning we are sinners, we are gashmi, we are far from God, and it's only our sense of busha our sense of being distant that reconnects us with God because we know we are distant. So unlike 20th century figures in which you can have a natural sense of your normal life being natural and you are not a sinner. So from Maharal to the Muslim movement, you wake up in the morning and you have to realize you're a schutz. And it's only your sense of shame, thank God, that lets you realize you're a schutz, that you are a minogol, you are gashmi, you have that distance. 20th century, you have a natural sense, of course. I'm not a minogol on a natural being. Let me just finish the four questions. Benny Gross is going to then compare this to whether existentialism is a being unto death, or the sense of our natural state of being fallen and materialistic. But Benny Gross leaves out that therefore for the Maharal, it's not that just we're schutz and therefore we're just like Sartre and then all these others. No, for them saying it's a human condition and we have to rely on it, Maharal says shame is the medium that lets me connect to the divine. So as an early modern figure, Maharal says shame lets me connect to God. So unlike a medieval, for whom my physicality is altogether nothing to do with God, my soul, my emotions, my enthusiasm, my childhood are all things that have nothing to do with my pure intellect, for medieval. And unlike a modern who actually enjoys these things, as an early modern, Maharal immediately expects you to identify it with something beyond. Now, just to give you an example of a contemporary of the Maharal, who says very similar things, if one considers someone like Luther, Martin Luther, who says that man is rotten and sinful in their natural state, and only through grace and God's mercy does a human being acquire the image of God, and that redeems them from their natural state. Maharal is going to be a more complex process of first starting with shame, and then the shame is then going to let you be aware that one has to acquire Tzelem Elohim. And now I want to talk about what is Tzelem Elohim to Maharal. So unlike medievals for whom a human being is Sefa, and unlike a 20th century figure whom human beings are now emotion, intellect, and memory, for Maharal, your Tzelem Elohim is a Seichel Nivdal, a separate intellect, that is cultivated by the keeping of mitzvot, not by study. And since your Tzelem Elohim involves both body and mind, mitzvot include nefesh and guf. But for Maharal, we were perfect in the womb. At that point, we had complete connection to God, we had complete Tzelem Elohim. And that's why the Midrash says that the Malach makes a little indent in our faces when we come into the world. Because we no longer have, what does it mean we forget our Torah? We no longer have Tzelem Elohim anymore. We are now in a world in which we are physical. And the doing mitzvot will recultivate our Sechel HaNivdal to get us back to where we started from, which was the status in the womb. So unlike whether it's medievals or moderns who assume the goal of Judaism is Shleimut, for Maharal it's always to get back to where you were in the womb. Yes?
Is that the Josh just from Plato?
Is that
like its own tradition?
It's antiquity, a lot of it. It's a lot of yeah. It's a whole, it's one of those things that's not coming from a paperback Platonism. It's coming from the fact that the entire world of late antiquity, from about everything from North Africa to the Orient, had some version of that. Which is a very different statement.
It's not coming from directly.
It means it antedates everybody in the system. That's their worldview. But I keep giving you, playing you off medieval, early modern, modern, rather than late antiquity. Late into the role, because that's before the time period I usually work. If you took a course in Midrash, the world of late antiquity has those elements of recollection, of dupartsufim, of, you know, lots of those elements that are accepted by almost everybody. As the neshama being imprisoned in the body. And in that, the Renaissance went back more to late antiquity in order to jump over the Middle Ages. Because the Middle Ages did not play up those elements. And even when the Middle Ages used those elements, they became cosmologies rather than psyches. So, for example, dupartsufim, rather than where late antiquity or the Renaissance assumes some androgyny, for the Kabbalist, it gets projected up as Tered and Malchut, it becomes a cosmos. So too, recollection, where for late antiquity or the Renaissance, there is a place we're getting, there's a sense of recollection, there's a memory we all carry, a trace that takes us back to some primordial moment, temporally. The Middle Ages projected this idea of recollection up into Bina, or some equivalent cosmology, depending on the system. And it was spatial rather than temporal. Okay. What am I up to? Okay, so for the Maharal, the goal is to get back to where you once were. Now let me add one thing, that's why I'm doing this outside. The difference between free will and free choice. Free will is whether I am volitionally free to create a brand new destiny for myself. Example of thinkers who hold free will are most 20th century figures, whether existential or not. We assume we are completely the captains of our own destiny. Or on the other end, 1,000 years ago, Sadigon, who had it really open whether we were going to be a Jew or a Buddhist or an atheist, was a question of free will. Free choice is whether I'm now in front of me choosing Pepsi or Coke, Hunan beef or chicken lo mein. It is that sense that I am choosing in the moment, but it's not necessarily affecting my destiny. Free will is about whether I am now, free choice is about whether I am right now choosing A over B. Hold on, no questions a second. So you can hold that we have no free will, that we must be a Yid, we must be a Jew. Unlike Sadia or a 20th century figure, you can hold there's no free will, we must become a Jew. But you can still hold free choice, that we can run away from it or make the wrong choices, but it doesn't ultimately affect who we are. Those of you who've taken Professor Johnson for philosophy, either metaphysics or his course on free will, Professor Johnson follows Peter von Inwagen, who, like Maharal, holds there is no such thing as free will. What? But does assume there is free choice. We clearly are choosing Coke versus Pepsi, or roll versus bread, or to sin or not sin, but that doesn't mean there is any free will going on. It is all predetermined in von Inwagen in one way, for Maharal in his own way. So I just want to question on that sense of choice before I tie it back into the Maharal. Yes?
Isn't this distinction between will and choice just dependent on our judgment of the meaningfulness or ramifications of the decision? Meaning, if we can say that decisions between choosing when to eat and chicken and chow mein is the same thing as choosing whether to be a Jew or to be a Hindu, then it's just a matter of our judgment of the decision. It really has nothing to do. There really is no difference.
Okay, for 20th century figures, yes. But Maharal, we have an inner panini essence in which that really does change things. So that's why the von Inwagen analogy goes so far. For Maharal, we have a real essence.
Meaning, those real essence would be a religion, but food is not a definitional.
Thank you. Now let's come full circle before I tie it back in. That's why a Talmud Chacham, back to our very first textual class, is already made a choice to be a Talmud Chacham, but if in his free will he charges interest, it's only a mikre, it's like a choice of Coke or Pepsi. It doesn't ultimately show he's a materialist over Ben Torah.
Both
are
your choice.
What?
Both are your choice.
Which, Coke or Pepsi?
Talmud Chacham and Coke or Pepsi.
For Maharal, no.
Talmud Chacham doesn't choose to be a Talmud Chacham because he doesn't have the will to do it. He is a Talmud Chacham,
right. But
he uses his choice in that.
Yeah, he's still, even if he's making the wrong choice now, but his essence.
Then why is it good to be a Talmud Chacham? Meaning, why is the person that's a Talmud Chacham good, meaning they just stay as far as acts, and they can make choices that go against them, they'll still be there.
That's correct.
I mean, why is it being
part of the
good thing?
For him, okay. That, now you're getting, speaking in Maharal terms, the answer is yes, because you have this intrinsic status of now being connected to God, which you would, despite the choices you make.
It's not a new behavior.
That's right. That's right. That's right. This is a status for the status of a Talmud Chacham, a Rav, a Gadol, has a status regardless of the scandals they're involved in. Those are only free choice, not their will. And the Maharal already told us that in that very first textual class we did, that even a Talmud Chacham that's charging ribbis, that's not a question of their will, it's only of their choice. See, everything will tie back on itself. Yes?
The Gemara speaks of a son of Yom Chachamim who was totally left. And you have the case of Acher.
Right.
So he obviously changed his destiny.
Not for Maharal. For Maharal, that's going to be, there's no changing of destiny. I mean, Maharal's going to go further when we do with his nationalism and his next of Israel. Maharal's going to make all Gerim were really at Har Sinai. Anyone who goes off really wasn't at Har Sinai. All destinies are already pre-sealed. Yes?
Was this like Tanya, where he asked the deacon, you can't become tzaddik?
100%. Tanya's a Maharal reader.
And becoming a Bannerman is a good choice.
That's correct. That is correct. Because we have, as in Tanya's Prakim 16, 17, those 18, when he talked about the need between fight our Yetzirah, we have to make a choice. But he already told you that our essence was Nefesh HaLukus Mimal. So we don't have a free will to go against it, we have a free choice to go against it. So even if we're listening to our Nefesh HaBamis, it doesn't do away with our Nefesh HaLukus.
So this is also the whole
60 or the Pintel Yid. 100%. Pintel Yid is based on a Maharal theme within Chassidus.
That exactly his origin? From Maharal?
Is
Pintel Yid?
Yes. Yeah. But it didn't take on Maharal. It came through Tanya and Kedushas Levi, and it really became big in Poland and Sfas Emes and others, in which we all have now Nekuda Kedosha, and it became part of Polish Yiddish to say everybody is a Pintel Yid. Okay, those are later outgrowths of this. See, unlike when we learn Zohar and you don't have to ever leave the Zohar to understand it, Maharal immediately became a cultural element that plays itself out just even in the language. More than anybody read Maharal, Maharal had an influence in these categories. You know, in many ways it became the philosophy of Eastern Europe for all sides. They spoke this language. Okay, what was I up to? So, where are we up to? Is back to Maharal. So for Maharal, when we're in the womb, we do nothing but what God wants. We do nothing but Ratzon Hashem. But our Tzelem Elokim, which combines both our guf and our nefesh, can make free choices. And the goal is to get yourself back to doing Ratzon Hashem. And Yirat Shamayim, is about understanding one's true Pnimiyut, one's true original starting point, and getting back to that point. So unlike Yirat Shamayim, which for Kabbalists is usually defined as Yediyat Hashem through the Sfirot and following what one has to do in mitzvot, here Yediyat Hashem is realizing your true nature. It's correcting your consciousness. Getting back to where you are, getting back to your true self. Getting to your inner yid. So Yirat Shamayim is not the knowledge of what you have to do. It's not a checklist of obedience. You know, Yirat Shamayim would be mocked to follow this, that, or the other thing. Yirat Shamayim is getting back to their true nature. So once you realize you are now caught in the realm of the physical, getting back to your true nature is what counts. And therefore emotions like busha help bridge the gap because they make you acutely aware of the distance. So unlike in the 20th century, if you have busha, you can solve it by doing something new. Like if I'm ashamed, I then can perfect my character, I can make myself a better person, I can now have better obedience, I can now do things that make myself no longer ashamed. For Maharal, it's not about new things to do. You know, it's sitting in the Bali Musar. No, if you're ashamed of who you are, the Bala Musa says, okay, therefore, you've got to go to the base medrash. an acquired Torah. For Maharal, it's all located in that very moment of shame, that somewhat conversionary moment when the light bulb goes off over your head to get back to that original moment. But that's where Yira fits in. Now, let's talk about angels a minute.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where is this all coming from?
Yeah.
Is this in Darakai?
This is going to all be in the Kivat Olam. I'm going to say all of it's in this Derechaim also. Derechaim is best for these other things, but I mean, I can give you from almost every Sefer some version of this. This is some of his basic thoughts. But until now, I've been giving you the building blocks. Now everything we're going to be saying is going to be based on everything else. For Maharal, humans are greater than angels. Because even though angels are higher in the cosmology, angels have no free choice. Angels have to do their task that God set them to do. But humans have free choice. In order to do God's will. And it's that so therefore, the volitional element is very important for Maharal, that you volitionally choose to do everything you're doing. That's why, let's go back, that's why when it comes to Tefillah, Schar Halicha counts. When it comes to Talmud Torah, Yigia and Amelis counts. That's why almost everything you're going to be doing, he's going to add those qualities. And it doesn't really matter which qualities get picked up by Hasidim and which by Mismagdim. You know, Mismagdim are more into the Amelis, and Hasidim are much more in the sense of Busha. The point is, it's all about that emotional level of you realizing what really counts. Less important is the doing it. I mean, the doing it affects mitzvot, affects you and perfect your secha. But it's that movement of the self that really counts in all of these. He also points out that angels cannot talk while humans can. Dibor is a quality that unifies mind and body. While angels don't have that unified mind-body that humans do. And when you make this right understanding, then you are connected to God. Yes? Maharal has a way of saying the Shira is universal, it's collective, while Dibor is individual.
Just like a bird can sing.
That's right. That's the example he gives. Birds and angels both sing. But that doesn't mean it's reflective of Panimi and a given choice. Some of the birds, if you listen carefully. I'll give you them twice afterwards.
Did you say it's the Mikado? Anyway, you hear angels saying Kadosh Kadosh?
Yeah.
You're not really saying that?
In the next week, so we're going to be doing these more inside.
Yeah, we're going to go back and do this inside. This is just introductions.
Not really saying it.
Yeah, I don't know. The other point here, as it reiterate the point we did when we talked about the Alan Senior article, is that where for a medieval there are humans, there are angels, and God sits on top of the cosmos, and where for a modern there are no angels, no cosmos, For Maharal, God is the center of all reality, and the angels are just located in a place called heaven, the same way you could have, for the Maharal, Africans living in Africa. It doesn't mean anybody's closer to God, because God is the center of everything. So he denies the cosmology here also. Man becomes the central point of creation, unifying the divine and the human. Humans are the only thing that have that sense of Ratzon, of Dibor, of Tzelem Elohim. But we're going to see this played out, and there's no chapter in Maharal called Tzelem Elohim, but there are chapters on all the virtues, and you're going to see this as one of the way he's going to explain why you need all the virtues in your life, meaning why you need Emunah, Emet, Tamimut, Ahavarecha Kamocha, why you need those qualities. He's going to use these premises when he's doing it. Okay, let's go on. For Maharal, all this is all background before we get to Midot. No action, no Mida has a function. The reason you do actions is to show quality. To show you have a quality of the divine. Meaning, for the Rishonim, for the Rambam, mitzvot and ethics all have a telos, they all have a purpose, they have to have an effect. If it doesn't have an effect, you blew it. Or a modern reframing of it, a maaseh has a kiyum. If you don't have the kiyum, you've really not gotten the best out of the maaseh. Or the language of the Sefer HaChinuch, every mitzvah has a shoresh of what its function is, how it affects the world. For Maharal, if things don't have an effect, you are showing the divine quality in the world. For Maharal, there is one single straight path, one derech, hence the title of his book on Pirkei Avot, Derech HaChayim. But the derech is broken into many netivot, many the word I want to use. But there are many trails on that path, or many lanes, within the lane would probably be the best one. There are many lanes, there are many netivot on the single derech. For Maharal, if you deviate from the derech, you are crossing into the realm of death. If you follow the derech, you get Olam Haba. And that's what Tzelem Elohim is. You follow the derech and you will wind up back where you started from. So unlike 20th century, that actually worries over death, that has anxiety over death, Maharal identifies the self completely, that if you worry, if you have a death, the answer is you follow the derech HaChayim. And all these netivot, the reason we have Amunah, Emet, Tmimut, Avarech, Kamalcha, Tzniut, Prishut, Shem Tov, Tshuva, are all ways of staying on the path. They don't accomplish anything. They are all the ways of staying on the path.
That is accomplishment.
It's not the accomplishment in the sense of you do this, you'll have an effect in the world, or an effect in the spheres, or even the effect on the self.
Well, we did say that once. We said that that in the Chagim, we said, how could chesed be, so chesed is Hashem's chesed, so we said, no, the Mishnah is talking about people's chesed.
Right.
And he said that when you do chesed, You cause Hashem to do that.
That's right. Because unlike for the Rambam or the Ramban or anyone else, or even for the Mechem Eliyahu, if you do chesed, you are becoming a chesed person, you are increasing chesed in the world. For the Maharal, if you do chesed, you're on the path, therefore God's chesed will show in the world. It shows you haven't drifted off of the path.
Very similar.
Very similar, but he keeps emphasizing the point that there's nothing you can do that can't be done. All that counts is you staying on the path, and therefore God will take care of everything. So if you don't do chesed, you fall off the path, and chesed doesn't occur in the world. He's taking it, man is not the protagonist here. Man has to do these things not to fall off the path.
Also, as a har, we say the path, yes, the reading we see was a Buddha, says that the path is one line, it's straight, it's one.
Right.
But once you go off, you are that crooked line, and that's your way.
Right. That's right. So that's why the point is that one single straight line is many that see votes. You need all of them to make the path. Yes.
Also,
straight path. That's it. That's why I'm doing this outside. You're going to start seeing this everywhere inside.
Okay.
Yeah.
How is chesed keeping on the path?
Because if you don't have chesed, you have stinginess, or you have din, and you've fallen off of the path. So it's not that you're bringing chesed to the world. It's not that you're showing kindness to the neighbor. But if you show kindness, it shows you're not showing stinginess. You're staying on a single path, and God will be the one who brings the kindness into the world. You're creating an ideal type of community. That's a perfect example. When you give tzedakah, for the Rambam gives you 8 levels of tzedakah, and the highest level is really, you know, giving someone a job, changing their life around. This is going to generate, you know, your Chabad customer giving a penny to tzedakah every day before you daven. The penny is having no effect on the world. It's not about the quantity. It's all about that continuous connection.
I ask you, Stira.
Yeah.
That Chabad comes to the wrong understanding.
I understand that. Before the Rambam, because for the Rambam it becomes a character trait that you have to do this every day to make yourself into a certain type of person, that if you give a penny each time and nick whatever coin you want, you then when the real situation occurs, you will take care of it. As opposed to the much more, you just do it during davening because it keeps you on the path. And you don't ask about the accountability of it or what effect it has. So anything, stinginess, laziness, stubbornness, you'll all fall off the path. And if you stay on the path, you have a quality called, new in tone, the word yosher. People who are on the path have a quality of yosher which connects them to God. Yosher is not a descriptive word, but the Maharal almost intones it like a big word. You have yosher. You have this quality of being on the path, and therefore you are connected. Okay? So it's not, don't think that yosher is a description, the opposite of krum, but yosher is a real quality that connects one to connects one to God. But then again, even in Yiddish, we then have to be yosher versus to be krum, you know, as being the whole language. So Maharal keeps generating, you start thinking this minhag, this Yiddishism, are all flowing out of these discussions. Yes?
That is the actual discussion. You said that according to the Maharaj, the whole point is to get back to the womb.
Right.
This doesn't sound like stuck on. The womb is only Torah, saying there's a lot.
No, for him, the word Torah means the whole realm of all midot. It's in his interpretation.
Yeah, but you can't get stuck in the womb, right?
But you weren't deviating to stinginess either. That's where the Maharal becomes Maharal, because he says in the womb you weren't stingy.
You were taking everything, you were giving nothing.
Not in his read. In his read, you were the perfect Zohar Elokim at that point. Okay, he says the Yetzirah has no effect on you when you're on the right path. He talks about the face reflecting positively. Your face is who you are, and all your good, everything good about you can be reflected as panim. That's right. On the other hand, your legs, your aglayim, is everything negative. So legs will stand for death, destruction, negativity. Face will stand for life, positive connection to God. We'll talk about more of that later in the class when we talk about his use of emblems. Okay, we're going to stop at this point.